2025 marks 40 years since HIV testing became available in Australia. It's a complex anniversary to be commemorating because it coincides with US President Donald Trump's gutting of USAID, one of the main bodies that funds global HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment and support. Joining me now to talk about Australia's leading role in the fight against HIV/AIDS and how the massive hole in funding might yet be filled is Bill Botell. Bill is Adjunct Professor at the University of New South Wales and a strategic health policy consultant. He was Chief of Staff to the Australian Health Minister, Dr. Neil Blewett, from 1983 to 1987, the critical years for responding to HIV/AIDS in this country. And he was an architect of that response. Bill, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me here, David.
So Labor came to power in 83,
yep,
knowing that HIV/AIDS had arrived in Australia.
And not much more than that. The first reported case was in Sydney, in Australia, reported in October of 82. That had caused some interest in academic and government circles, but not very much. So when Neil Blewett became health minister in March 83, he was given a huge briefing book. He was there basically to do Medicare, to remember that Medicare
was to restore Medicare.
Put Medicare in. It was ready to go, but it had to be put through the parliament and commence work on that almost immediately. So that was the big job that Neil Blewett was expected to do. But in the huge briefing book that was prepared somewhere on the second day, item number 102,
Subsection 4,
the briefers said, there is this thing that we've heard called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency syndrome, and something happened about it in Sydney a few months ago, and that was it. So really the Dr. Blewett, the incoming Hawke government, came right at the beginning of when the problem started to emerge in Australia in the large cities.
What happened to make you realise that this needed to be addressed urgently? Because that young man who died, he was a traveller from America, wasn't he? And there was this sense that it was a problem over there.
It was, but over that Christmas New Year period of 82, 83, and increasingly in 83, there had been people turning up who were very ill, not just in America, but increasingly in Australia and in Sydney. And this was getting around the medical profession and the communities, the gay communities and others in Australia. And there was increasing coverage of it in some of the press. In those days, of course, Time and Newsweek and the weekly news magazines were the way in which the world news was filtered into Australia. So it was being picked up there. But there was increasing concern, and that was being transmitted when we came to government to Dr. Blewett and to myself and to others. So the pressure then went on the Department of Health, plural, around Australia, to say what is going on, what's happening, what is this all about? And bit by bit, we really geared ourselves up to try to determine what was going on, to collect the information. Or we knew that people were in terrible states with illnesses that had never been reported in modern times before and were very sick, and then people started dying.
Then you went to America in that first year?
As 93 wore on and... 83 wore on and the situation became more concerning, and it became apparent that it was in fact a virus, because we've all had the experience of COVID where almost immediately the disease became apparent. It became apparent it was a virus, then the tests came in.
Yes, within, all sort of immediately.
And so on, almost immediately. It was not like that then. People did not know what it was.
How it was transmitted.
Or how it was transmitted or not transmitted. People had educated guesses that it was a virus. But it wasn't until later in 83 that it was confirmed that it was a virus. Therefore, how was it transmitted? therefore could there be a test? And in later 83, I remember just after the legislation to establish Medicare had been put through the Senate, Neil decided to go to America, the fount of all wisdom, we thought, to discuss the emerging problem with the best people in the world, the American medical and health people and the politicians and so on. So we went. And really, it was, to say it's a shambolic circus would be to overstate things. The politicisation of the response to AIDS was well underway in America then.
Because it was President Reagan?
President Reagan was there.
And he stood for family values.
He stood for family values, but in effect he outsourced the response to AIDS to several of the most extreme fundamentalist senators in the United States. And through 83, there was an increasing view that AIDS, as it had mostly been reported in gay men and Haitians and sex workers and other undesirables, that it was God's punishment.
And they actually said that in my memory.
And in Australia at the time, we were just amused by it, I think. Nobody could remotely think that this approach would inform the approach of the government of the United States about what to do. They would take the advice of their scientists and the communities and so on and come to some sensible understanding of how things might be tackled. But in fact, this approach in the United States, the politicisation, the crazy explanations of what was going on, divine punishment, were the predominant way in which the government was responding to it. And it was also politically difficult that the big problems were in New York and San Francisco particularly, which were politically at odds with the Republican
administration. Of course, they were Democrat cities.
Yeah, and I can remember in those meetings, people said to Neil's face, look, let them die. It's clearly only affecting undesirables and people that we're better off without, so they can die. We don't care. And it's a shocking thing when that's said to your face by people at the senior reaches of government and you realise that they mean it. And, of course, this just compounded then through 83 and 84. The Americans just checked out. They had tremendous scientists, however, tremendous researchers. They had the institutions of government, the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, the big universities. Certainly in there were scientists and others who were working full bore to understand more about the disease, who were looking for the evidence and who were coming up with very innovative and sensible ways of responding to the problem, but these were not being translated into the policies of the US government.
Well, Bill, you can't be particularly surprised by the present United States government recommending against measles vaccinations.
Against measles vaccinations. But what is terrible now is it's 40 years, and I feel we've come in an enormous circle. Back then, Reagan and his people were eventually shamed into doing something. It took them 4 years when bold and resolute and swift action taken in America and internationally could really have stopped the problem, could have made the problem a serious and manageable problem, but their inaction made it become a global pandemic. They did not move quickly and effectively as we did in Australia. But at least there was the argument in the United States. I think Neil met Dr. Tony Fauci for the first time in that visit. But there were people and institutions who were doing the right thing, making the arguments and convincing public opinion and political opinion in America that it couldn't go on like that.
I'm talking to Bill Botell, these days adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales. But back as the epidemic began, he was chief of staff to Dr. Neil Blewett, the health minister. Bill, It was still a couple of years before a test was discovered. How did people diagnose HIV/AIDS before the test? You just had to wait for the symptoms to emerge.
Well, once people understood that it was most probably a virus, you could then develop a test for that virus. And that was a matter of hit and miss in the early days. Certainly, when the first tests became available about 85, they threw up a lot of false results. They took many weeks to get back from the laboratories sometimes, but it was better than nothing. And then people would really only have the tests when they had symptoms, which meant that it was they were not coming forward to test for HIV so much as they were coming forward when something had gone really wrong, by which stage there was nothing that could be done because there were no effective treatments.
So what was the use of taking the test? I can remember people being very reluctant to take the test on the grounds that, you know, what was the point of knowing? If I am positive, I'll die.
Well, that was the point, but after a couple of years, what came along was, funnily enough, a drug that had been touted to be a response to cancer, a cancer drug that had failed, called AZT. But it was found that this drug could stop the HIV virus, could diminish it. And AZT became the basis of clinical trials, experimental treatments, but people found that if you had AZT, it offered some hope that you would not progress quickly to death.
When was it available in Australia?
About 85, 86. But what we did in Australia, which was so useful, was that thanks to the organisation within the gay community, thanks to our researchers and clinicians in 83, 4, 5, we really quickly got organised for drug trials and for cohort studies. And this became enormously useful to the big international drug companies who found it very difficult to do these trials in the United States and elsewhere because of the politics. So we very quickly had trust built up. People thought that if they acknowledged they had HIV and so on, that they weren't going to be sacked from their job or discriminated against, or cops would come or something like that. This really, really helped because it meant that experimental therapies, new ideas, new ways of doing things could be tested and reported to the international companies and drug companies and internationally. And our people with HIV or who are ill really got a lot of fantastic therapies very early on, which they wouldn't otherwise have got. So it was good.
How long was AZT the principal way of addressing the problem?
AZT was for about 10 years. The problem with taking AZT and its related treatments was that people had to take sometimes up to 40 pills a day and take them every 2 hours.
Yeah.
So they had to wake up to take them. And compliance with 40 pills a day is really difficult. But in a sense, doing that treatment was better than dying, of course, but it was a very rugged and not very effective treatment, but in some people it worked. It was only in 1996 that so-called combination therapies came along that reduced dramatically this number of pills that had to be taken, and that obviously became better for the people who were suffering from HIV, and they became better and better. But between 83 and 96, apart from AZT, what we understood here was that prevention was possible. HIV is not like COVID. COVID is spread in aerosol. It's easy to transmit. HIV was very difficult relatively to transmit. It had to be transmitted in semen or in blood. obviously it was not being transmitted every time there was sexual relations between people. So it meant that there was a way of preventing its spread or reducing its spread at a population level. And that's where the use of condoms, of clean needles for injecting drug users, use of condoms by sex workers and so on, all of that became a very effective way in which we started to bring down the rate of new HIV infections as early as 86 and 87, bring them down in the sense that the rates started to decline. They still were going up, but they were declining because people changed their behaviours and stuck at it, which was remarkable, really.
Let's jump from the point at which we were getting things under control in Australia to what has been happening under USAID assistance. What were they doing? What has stopped? What is now going to happen?
40 years ago, the barbarians and the crazy people were not quite, were at the gates, but they hadn't taken over the institutions of the United States. Now, regrettably, with the administration in the United States, the big funders of the global response have been the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, which was set up in 2002 by President George Bush Jr. with the help of Clinton and Mandela, Gates and others. It started to pour billions and billions of US dollars into treatments, into access around the world for people on treatment. The other ones have been the National Institutes of Health. They fund research into vaccines, into treatments, and they've been huge funders. All of these institutions have now been smashed, and the money that they provided has either been withdrawn or is under great threat. At the same time, of course, they're attacking the big university institutions where a lot of this other basic research is being done, and that's created enormous uncertainty.
Bill, what's the motive?
Look, I think when I look at this, and having been in for 40 years, there is a certain sadistic cruelty in what is being done. To a degree, back 40 years ago, there was ignorance, there was sort of cynicism in a political way, but even in the United States, once President Reagan woke up to what was going on in about 85, the big institutions of American government started to do something, which was great, and they provided this money and the funding, and they got going after the turn of the century. Now, you have to say that why would you attack an institutions that are funding tests for 84 million people, HIV treatments for 20.6 million people, employing 340,000 healthcare workers to deliver those treatments and tests, predominantly but not only in sub-Saharan Africa. And now we're on the verge of lenacapavir and these new treatments that are going to take over from PrEP, so you have them injected twice a year. This is a tremendous game changer on the horizon. Right at the time, now the Americans, for whatever reason, are just pulling away and saying, you can die. We don't care. This is a very odd set of values to me, and I'm sure to most of the rest of the world.
Bill, in under 50 words, what's going to happen?
There has to be a coalition of nations and donors who have to step up to fill the gap in the United States' shortfalls. I think a lot of discussion has to take place with China, with Saudi Arabia and other people in the world who have the financial resources to step in to cover the gaps that are now being creating havoc in the world thanks to the Americans. I hope that can be done. I think Australia's got a part to play in that. If we don't do that, what we run is the risk of the direction of travel reversing. More HIV cases between now and 2030, maybe 6 million more, 4 million more deaths. And when that reverses, when the weight of money is taken off that strategy and you allow the thing to get out of hand, we face the problem we did 40 years ago. We didn't move fast enough, and a manageable problem became an unmanageable one. I mean, 40 million people died because of the mistakes made in the 1980s. And we're now at a critical moment. If we don't move quickly to cover that funding, we are going to have serious problems around the world, in our region. We already have a small uptick in Fiji, for example, and we will not have the management and control of what we would hope would be the final stages of HIV as a problem in the world. We are right at the edge of getting rid of it as a public health problem in the world. Why would we go backwards? But if we don't move quickly, we will.
Bill, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks, David.
I've been joined by Bill Botell, who these days is an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales. He is, and he won't forgive me for saying this, kind of the grand old man these days of fighting the epidemic all the way back 40 years ago. You don't mind grand old man, do you?
No, grand old man. It's who ever thought would get here? I never thought back in the 80s when this happened we'd still be carrying on about it 40 years later, but here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks, David.